Inside Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast, powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. I've brewed up a robust cup of coffee, and we have queued up a robust podcast today. I'm joined, as always, by from Tallahassee by the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief, John Kennedy.
Hi, George.
And joining John there in the historic Florida Press Center in Tallahassee is Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson.
Hey, George. Session is almost over, and we got it all covered.
All right. So, and you fellas there in Tallahassee got to witness kind of a living history lesson this week. Jeb Bush was in the Capitol as a bill to expand school vouchers was winning approval in the Florida legislature. Kind of a throwback to those heady 1990s days when the Republican Party was on the rise in Florida and pushing a lot of ambitious new conservative policies with Jeb Bush's stamp on them. But this is the 21st century, and the Republican Party is now very much the party of Donald Trump rather than Jeb Bush. So fittingly, while Jeb was still in the building this week, Republican lawmakers were also advancing a very non-Jebian bill to limit so-called sanctuary cities. So John and Zach are going to tell us more about those issues on the podcast. Also, the Mueller report suggests that Russians were able to hack into at least one county election system somewhere in Florida in 2016. Is Governor Ron DeSantis worried about that happening again in the 2020 presidential election? His answer might surprise you. We will talk about that a little later. And speaking of 2020, former Vice President Joe Biden has emerged as the clear early front runner in the crowded Democratic presidential race. There's always a Florida connection to everything. And so we will hear on this podcast from the Palm Beach County resident who has a small but potentially significant role in the Biden campaign. But first, I believe I'm hearing some music that is funky and royalty free. And listeners of the podcast know when you hear that music, it means it's time for our pick a number segment. That's the portion of the podcast where each of us puts forward a number. And then later on, we explain what that number means in Florida politics. Zach Anderson, guesting there in the Tallahassee studio. Why don't you go first? What's your number this week?
Well, George, it's the end of session. Lawmakers are closing in on a budget, and there's a lot of big numbers being thrown around. So I'm going to go big with a $33
million. Zach Anderson coming in very big, $33 million. John Kennedy, what about you? What's your number this week?
George, my number, I'm using all my allotted decimal places this week. Mine is 2.4.
2.4 for John Kennedy. As always, we not only allow but encourage decimal points on the podcast. And George Bennett, that's me. My number is going to be 5. So just to review very quickly, John Kennedy from lowest to highest. John Kennedy came in with a 2.4, George Bennett with a 5, and Zach Anderson off the grid with a $33 million. Hang on to those numbers, teach them to your children, write them on your doorposts and on your gates, and we will review them again at the end of the podcast. But let's get straight to our loaded lineup. As Zach and John mentioned, the legislative session is nearly complete, and all kinds of significant legislation is being passed, more than we can do justice to on one podcast. But there were two issues I mentioned at the top, the school vouchers and sanctuary cities, that we're going to talk a little bit about today, because I think they say a lot about the past and the future direction of the Republican Party in America's largest swing state. So let's cue up that Tallahassee theme music. There it is, Swamp Rock, the royalty-free Tallahassee theme music. So let's start with that sanctuary cities thing. Well, John Kennedy, set the scene for us. Why was Jeb Bush in the Capitol this week?
Well, Jeb was looking on in the state house as the chamber passed the new Family Empowerment Scholarship. This is the latest iteration of vouchers in Florida. This can pay for as many as 18,000 students a year to attend private schools. Now, the thing unique about this new voucher program is that money would come directly from what's called the Florida Education Finance Program, better known as the FEFP, which is the public money that goes to public schools. It's going to total about maybe as much as $136 million this year, coming right out of taxpayer money and going right to the new empowerment scholarship that would go directly to private schools then.
Just not to get too wonky, but yeah, explain where has that voucher money come from in the past?
Yeah, the biggest voucher program that exists right now is called the Tax Credit Scholarship Program, and that is a little bit of a diversion where corporations dedicate a certain amount of their tax obligation to these scholarships. So it's kind of a, you know, Rube Goldbergian kind of creation where the money is not really considered taxpayer money because it hasn't gone into the treasury yet. By contrast, this Family Empowerment Scholarship would come right from the treasury. And a lot of people say that that will fly in the face of a 2006 state Supreme Court ruling that overturned then Governor Jeb Bush's first in the nation statewide voucher program that passed during his first session as governor back in 1999. That voucher program also used taxpayer money directly, and Supreme Court justices at that time said you can't do that violates the state constitution. So we are poised for another legal challenge stemming from this new voucher program that's been created. You know, it'll take a little while to unfold, but doubtlessly somebody probably connected to the Florida Education Association, the state's largest teachers union, which opposed the Jeb voucher back in, after it was passed in 1999, and also will oppose this latest version of a voucher.
And so the difference is, as you pointed out in your article this week across our Gatehouse publications, the Florida Supreme Court has changed ideologically from the one that shot down the voucher program in 2006. Three of those liberal justices retired and were replaced by presumably conservative justices that Governor Ron DeSantis appointed this year. But John, as you say, you're expecting that this will come down to a court showdown.
Yeah, pretty much guaranteed. And, a sign that Republicans that control the legislature, while they're very confident in this program and, they're kind of saying, oh, we don't really see that it defies the 2006 ruling by the Supreme Court. They did very quietly this week tuck an additional $250,000 into the Department of Education's budget for legal costs, basically anticipated legal costs that are likely to, stem from any kind of voucher lawsuit that's probably on the horizon.
Okay. And the reason I thought, school vouchers is a big issue, obviously, but the thing that I thought was significant is it really is a testament. Jeb Bush was elected governor 20 years ago and put his mark on the Republican Party in Florida, very much a policy wonk and animated by a lot of conservative policy ideas. Vouchers was one of them. And in many ways, the Republican Party today in Florida owes a lot of its dominance and, can trace that all back to Jeb Bush. And so Jeb Bush was there in the chamber when this passed this week, but lest there be the nostalgia bubble was burst a little bit, though, because at the same time that the voucher thing was passing as a triumph for Jeb Bush, legislators were also advancing these sanctuary cities bills, which are very much more of a Trumpian policy than the kind of immigration policy that Jeb Bush advocated. Zach Anderson, tell us about sanctuary cities legislation.
Yeah, nothing illustrates how the party of Jeb has morphed into the party of Trump more than the sanctuary city issue. You know, Jeb is kind of famously a little bit more open to immigration reform and things like a pathway to legal status for folks in this country, whereas the party has obviously moved far away from that under Trump and really embraced some hardline immigration policies. And the sanctuary city issue has really roiled the legislature this year. It was up again in the House yesterday, and we saw a lot of protest. Immigrant rights groups were in the Capitol in force trying to kill the bill. I think we have some audio of that. So there you get a flavor of what it was like outside the House chamber in the Capitol Rotunda as dozens of protesters were calling this sanctuary city law racist. They actually got into the House gallery and they were unfurling banners and yelling at the lawmakers from the House gallery and had to be removed by the sergeant at arms there. So really tense atmosphere as lawmakers close in on passing a bill that would outlaw sanctuary policies. This bill has been cheered on by the Trumpian wing of the party. Trump himself has really focused on sanctuary cities and said that he's going to, quote, dump immigrants in sanctuary cities in places like California. Governor Ron DeSantis has really pushed for this law, and it's a big shift from where the party was under Jeb Bush. And there was a reporter, Gary Finout, the great former AP reporter, now with Politico, got an exclusive with Jeb. I'm told that he actually reached out to somebody with Jeb's team and was told to meet him in the parking lot for a quick interview. And Gary asked Jeb about the sanctuary city law, and Jeb was pretty straightforward about what he thought about it. He said, quote, "This is one of those new political issues where it's designed to make a point rather than to solve a problem." So he's basically saying that Republicans are trying to score political points and that we don't really have a problem with sanctuary cities in Florida, which is funny because that's the exact argument the Democrats have been making, that this is all about politics. There's no real issue here. Law enforcement is cooperating with the federal government, and this is just really going to make it more difficult for immigrants by just adding more pressure on them to sort of deputize them to be like federal immigration agents. So interesting to hear Jeb come out and sort of undercut the law a little bit.
And kind of a testament to where the Republican Party is today, though, that Jeb Bush was making that comment from the parking lot somewhere rather than the Oval Office.
But
that's an issue. We'll certainly, sort of a tone setter for 2020. And speaking of 2020, the Mueller report included a kind of an oddly worded passage. If you read the Mueller report, 400 some pages, there's this brief passage that talks about Russian efforts to hack into election systems in Florida just before the 2016 presidential election. And it says, quote, "We understand the FBI believes that this operation enabled the GRU, that was the Russian hacking unit, to gain access to the network of at least one Florida county government. The office did not independently verify that belief and, as explained above, did not undertake the investigative steps that would have been necessary to do so." So it's kind of like, by the way, it's just interesting language for a report written by prosecutors. "We understand the FBI believes," as kind of imprecise and vague and doesn't say what county it was. Well, naturally, in Florida, it's caused kind of an uproar. And Governor Ron DeSantis was in Hope Sound recently. I caught up with him, and here was what he said just about the level of information that has been provided to the state about this.
The report came out in March. Obviously, they probably were writing it for months. You know, I took office in January. They never once reached out to my administration and said, hey, Governor, there was an issue in Florida 2 years ago. You may want to look at it. I definitely would have looked at it, and we'll look at whatever they give us. So I'm just disappointed that they haven't been more forthcoming.
So you know, Governor DeSantis even does not know, he said, where this hacking might have taken place, and he's disappointed that he doesn't know. He's supposed to get a briefing from the FBI next week. Now, one person that did know it came out was Senator Marco Rubio, by virtue of his position on the Senate Intelligence Committee. It came out that he knew a little bit about this sometime last year, but was not really able to say anything about it. And Senator Rick Scott, who was governor last year when this happened, or was governor in 2016 when this happened, he also said he didn't know. Both Scott and DeSantis are supposed to get briefings from the FBI this week that will hopefully shed some more light on exactly what happened and where, and whether any kind of steps need to be taken to secure Florida's election systems in 2020. And so, a reporter asked Governor DeSantis this week whether he's worried about some kind of hacking happening again in 2020. Here was his answer.
Well, it's hard for me to be worried or not worried because I don't know the facts. I mean, if they tell me kind of what the problem was, then I can know.
Okay, so kind of a exasperated Governor Ron DeSantis. And as I said, we'll probably know a little more in the next week or so. If it's not classified, he has said he wants to make everything public if he's allowed to. So, but that'll be, you know, an interesting thing hanging over 2020 elections in Florida, which is always a close and controversial state. John Kennedy or Zach Anderson, what do you how big a deal do you think this is?
I think it's such a weird story. It's just bizarre that we can't figure out like what exactly happened here. This has been, as you mentioned, it's been out there since the 2018 election. You know, Bill Nelson got a lot of criticism from Rick Scott for bringing this up. Now it looks like Bill Nelson was right and that this was an issue, that there was some hacking going on in some Florida election office, according to what the Mueller report is saying, according to their understanding of the FBI. But you would think that if there's a problem, that the officials would really have notified people on the ground. But the supervisors of elections in Florida say they don't know anything. So it's just a really odd story. Hopefully we'll get some more information once DeSantis gets briefed on this.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Florida is always known for its screw-ups in elections. And now, you know, was there a Russian interference that may have inspired some of the screw-up? That's going to be one of the questions that will probably cloud 2020. And then we also have in Florida, you know, there's an effort right now to finalize voter restoration legislation. We're recording this podcast on Thursday morning. Legislature's soon to wrap up, and that voter restoration effort will probably be brought to completion. But that's another one where there are going to be questions about the eligibility of voters as well. That could go into next year's election. And it's another area where there are going to be doubts about the veracity of some of the returns, probably in many counties.
Yeah, so something else to keep an eye on. Now, Paul Lux is the election supervisor in Okaloosa County, and he's the head of the State Association of Election Supervisors. And I talked to him this week, and he said he didn't know which county it was. He emphasized, he seemed to think that this whatever intrusion the Russians made was probably to like a it did not affect vote totals, you know, or the tabulating of votes, but they might have gotten access or been close to having access to voter information, which you know, can also wreak havoc on an election. But definitely one other thing to watch in Florida as 2020 approaches. Well, our final 2020 note is Joe Biden. When we were recording our podcast last week, was right as Joe Biden was announcing that he was getting in the presidential race. Not a big surprise. In fact, podcast listeners will recall back in January, Joe Biden's brother, Frank Biden, who lives here in Palm Beach County, in an exclusive interview with the Palm Beach Post, predicted his brother was going to run and that he would win over disaffected voters who Donald Trump had won in 2016. Well, so now Biden is, in fact, in the race, and a few national polls have come out showing him as the clear front runner. Even if you don't believe the polling data, I think one of the best indicators that Biden's the front runner is the amount of attention that President Donald Trump has paid to him. Here's a clip. You know, Donald Trump is, I think, 72, going to turn 73 this year. Joe Biden is 76, and I believe he will turn 77 later this year. And Donald Trump was talking to reporters at the White House this week about the issue of age. Here's what the president had to say.
How old are you going to be president? Well, I think that I just feel like a young man. I'm so young. I can't believe it. I'm the youngest person. I am a young, vibrant man. I look at Joe. I don't know about him. I don't know.
Is he too old?
I would never say anyone's too old. I know they're all making me look very young, both in terms of age and I think in terms of energy. I think you people know that better than anybody.
So throwing a little ageism on Joe Biden there. So Frank Biden, we mentioned, the younger brother of Joe, who lives here in Palm Beach County. I talked to him the other day, and I was asking him, you know, what's his role going to be in his brother's campaign? Here's what he told me.
I'm his workout advisor in chief. I'll make sure he stays in shape, as good a shape as he's in now while he's on the trail. You know, he's watched his health very closely. He's in terrific shape. And, you know, that's one of my avocations.
Right.
So I speak to him every day and make sure he's taking care of himself you know, continues to do what he's been doing. He's habituated in it. And so it's no surprise why he's as energetic and looks as good as he does at his age and my age.
Yeah, Frank Biden is, I think, 65. He's maybe 11 years younger than Joe. And Frank's a very fit man. And Joe Biden, I think, is a pretty fit looking man for a guy in his 70s. I hope to look that good when I'm that old. But you know, as you can see from the president's comments, I think that's going to be an issue. So I asked Frank Biden what he thought about Trump casting aspersions on Joe Biden's age and energy level. Here's what Frank Biden had to say about that.
I don't know. I wish somebody had asked the president if he can walk 18 holes of golf. Or when's the last time he did? Yeah, that's kind of funny.
All right. So if age becomes an issue in this, if Biden is the nominee and age becomes an issue, Frank Biden, workout advisor in chief here in Florida, could be a key factor. John Kennedy, I know during the Senate race, I remember you mentioning a few times, you know, Rick Scott raised the age issue against Bill Nelson. How do you think that'll play out?
I guess it's always kind of dangerous in Florida, where it's a pretty senior population, to start, you know, throwing shade on somebody because of their age. But Scott did a very similar thing to Nelson. Scott was 66, I believe, at the time, and Nelson was maybe as much as a decade older or thereabouts. So that was something that he was able to cast at his opponent. But it's a risky gambit in Florida, it would seem.
But George, I remember you bringing up that even older voters sometimes can be bad with ageism and saying, oh, we want to let you know, the new generation come in. And so it'll be interesting. It didn't keep Rick Scott from getting elected, going after Nelson on his age. It's worth noting that the oldest candidate in the race is actually Bernie Sanders. I think Trump was alluding to that a little bit too. But between Sanders and Biden, Sanders is 77. you know, the two Democratic front runners are both older than Trump, which is kind of maybe ironic a little bit for the party that's supposed to be better known for youth and diversity.
Yeah, well, it would be interesting, you know, if by next year you could have two guys running for president with a combined age of, you know, north of 150. Something to watch there. All right. Well, I think I'm hearing that funky royalty-free music again. Where did the time go? Let's go back to that pick a number segment. Let's go highest to lowest this week. Zach Anderson, way out there with that 33 million number. Tell me what that means.
33 million is the amount of money that the legislature has agreed to spend on the Florida Forever program, which is the state's marquee land conservation program. That's a big reduction from what Governor Ron DeSantis wanted, which was $100 million, which I believe is what is in the current budget for the program. And it's also a big reduction from what the program historically has received, which was an average of around $300 million back in the days of Jeb Bush. It was sort of universally agreed on that program was going to be funded at a fairly high level. And it's interesting, you know, DeSantis really went after the legislature for not following the will of the voters on the medical marijuana constitutional amendment, which voters approved in 2016. And DeSantis forced the legislature to basically legalize smokable medical marijuana, saying that that's what voters intended when they passed that constitutional amendment. Well, there was also a constitutional amendment on conservation that voters passed by more than 70%. And a lot of people say that that was aimed at buying land, although the legislature found a way to get around that and not dedicate large sums of money to land conservation. So it'll be interesting if DeSantis comes out and wraps the legislature over the knuckles on this issue as hard as he did on medical marijuana.
All right. Strong number there. I'm next, I guess. My number is five. Five is the number of PhDs on a new five-member task force appointed by Governor DeSantis to advise him on combating Florida's blue-green algae problem, with legislators likely to grant DeSantis the $625 million for water projects that he has requested for the budget year that begins July 1. The governor wants this this group of PhDs to advise him on the projects that'll be ready then or soon after that, the best ones to reduce nutrients and combat blue-green algae. So I think it's just significant. You know, a lot of these task forces, you know, sometimes you pick like an environmentalist and a developer and, you know, maybe somebody from one of the Indian tribes or something. But this one is five people with, you know, water science backgrounds, and DeSantis has indicated he wants to move quickly on the blue-green algae issue. Our last number is 2.4 from John Kennedy. What's that number?
George, 2.4 is billions of dollars bigger. That's the 91.1 billion dollar state budget that has been agreed by lawmakers this week. That's the distance between that $91.1 billion budget and the current year's spending plan. The new one that's coming out is the biggest budget in state history, but that claim can be made most years. And all told, it's really less than a 3% increase over the $88.7 billion budget that's set to expire on July 1st. So it's fairly modest, given the way the state's economy has been strong, meaning tax collections have been fairly robust. And the $91.1 billion plan still has to undergo scrutiny from Governor DeSantis, who could trim it down some with his vetoes. Right now, it doesn't seem like the governor is going to be that aggressive, maybe, on vetoes. Republican legislators are pretty happy with their first year governor, and some of that mellow, though, can be harshed pretty quickly if the governor lays in pretty heavy with vetoes, which you know, remains a possibility. But that drama is still a few weeks down the road.
Nothing like some vetoes to ruin a good feeling in the Once the legislative session's over, that's always the next big thing to watch, is when the line item vetoes start coming down. Well, we will be right on top of that in future podcasts, but this one is just about done. Thank you all for listening to another Inside Florida Politics podcast. I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, and I have been joined by the Tallahassee tag team this week of Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy and Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson. Here in West Palm Beach, I have been assisted by Joe Forzano in the studio, queuing up all those sound clips. And as always, the man behind the curtain in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the Gatehouse Digital Audio Production Director, Adam Fish. Thank you.